Now, as already announced, the topic of our discussion this evening is the question of sex education. As we all know, there has been much debate going on in our country on the question of sex education, that is, whether what they call as sex education should be introduced in the school as one of the items of curricula or not. So, educationists, parliamentarians, teachers, psychologists, sociologists, journalists, they all have been debating the question vigorously. But the question is quite controversial. There are two distinct views. One is against the proposal, the other is for it. Those who are against it are of a traditional mindset. Their argument is that if that is done, if what is conceived as sex education is introduced in the schools, then the traditional restraint that Indian social ethos has will be undermined, and it gives rise to immorality and promiscuity. This is the argument put forward by those who are against the proposal. But on the other hand, those who are protagonists of it say that proper sex education in the schools will enable children to manage their turbulent emotional disturbance they undergo during adolescence. They'll be able to manage that better, and that the children will be better equipped and better informed, and therefore in a better position to avoid falling victims to sex abuses and exploitation that is going on in our society and which is very disturbingly on the rise. And they also say that it enables children to protect themselves against sex-related diseases. So these are some of the points that are prominently discussed in the public debate. Now, what is very noticeable in this debate is the absence of moral bearing on the question of sex education, on the problem of sex itself. And the whole question is dealt with on the basis of emotional, physiological and sociological angle, as the modern psychologists and sociologists view it. Now, for the purpose of our discussion this evening, the question is not whether the so-called sex education as I conceive it should be introduced in the schools or not to be introduced in the schools. There is another question before us. The question before us is to consider the whole problem and riddle of sex, a most powerful driving force in human life, in all nature. Raise it to the moral plane and understand the deep riddle of sex in terms of spiritual knowledge, which unfortunately is totally missing in India today, though it was well known and formed social ethos in the ancient past. If the question is not this question of problem of sex, and as well as any other question for that matter relating to social reform or any other reform, will never bear fruit unless the whole thing is considered in the light of spiritual knowledge. So in absence of such a knowledge, any reform that they may do in this particular area under discussion will not only be of not much use, but it may produce ill effects worse than the reform they worse than what it is people are concerned with. Now, where does the question of religion comes here? But unfortunately, religions as we have today throws very little light on it, because religions have become mere dead letter dogmas. We have only sectarian religions, institutionalized religions. The true spiritual knowledge is lost. We have knowledge in the ancient teachings and scriptures, but they are buried deep in symbolism, like diamond buried in the bowels of the earth, and there is no one who is able to discern the spirit underlying it, underlying the scriptures. Now, a tree is useful so long as there is sap. If the sap dries up, what does the tree become? Dead wood. Similarly, religions are like a tree. Each, what gives life to them is spiritual knowledge, like sap gives life to the tree. Bereft of the sap, tree is dead. Bereft of spiritual knowledge, religion is dead. Dead letter is attended to. Letter killeth, spirit giveth life, is one of these theosophical sayings. So, HBB says, the tragedy of India, the fall of India, is because of loss of the spiritual knowledge. Now, the problem of sex is the deepest mystery of life, a great enigma. And science, as we know, knowing man just to be a physical animal and no more, cannot go beyond physical anatomy and physiology, is of little help. In fact, many of its theories and practices is very harmful to the true inner life of man. Religions, as already said, have been falsified by wrong interpretation, wrong understanding, and mere dogmatic enforced beliefs have reduced to mere taboos and enforced behavior from outside. All this will not work. So what is required is theosophia, divine wisdom. And it is a mission of the theosophical movement to revive and bring up again this spiritual knowledge of highest antiquity, which at one time flourished in India, now dead. So, of course, in a brief talk like this, very little justice can be done to the vast, complex subject. But what we will do is, we will give a very broad outline of the moral bearing and the spiritual knowledge underlying this mystery of sex by taking up a few readings from the Secret Doctrine. And then try to form some idea of it. Now, first of all, as already said, man is not just a mere physiological machine. He is a spiritual being. Let's understand that first. One of the ancient items of psychology says, man is a threefold being. He is just a physical body. And there is that inner, vital, invisible, inner man within the outer physiological man. That inner man is again an emanation of universal spirit. So, his spirit, the soul, inner man, and the outer man, physical, is a threefold being. So, in nature, in the whole universe, there is a threefold evolution. The whole universe is an expression and a manifestation of spirit, which alone is eternal, immutable, indestructible, all-pervading. Some of these basic ideas we must never forget. So, the whole universal manifestation is for the purpose of the spirit coming to self-knowledge. In other words, in that one life, self-consciousness arises, and self-consciousness strives to arrive at its complete self-knowledge. Self-conscious realization of omniscience and omnipotence of its inherent spiritual self. This is the whole purpose of evolution. So, for the spirit to come to such self-knowledge, jnana, atma-jnana, it requires a vehicle, body, form. And that form constitutes the physical line of evolution. The form that is made is first of all very subtle, ethereal, on the fashion of the manifested Brahma or Logos, heavenly man, and which becomes consolidated, and physical nature builds the matter around it, physical matter around it. This is the scheme of evolution that the ancient teachings give. This is physical line of evolution in which spirit is there. But spirit can never come in touch with the form, physical form, most perfect. Human form is the most perfect in the whole universe, because the subtle human form on which a gross body is built has all the potentialities, centers in the macrocosmos, so it is in touch with the whole of macrocosmos. Now, spirit cannot come in touch with the body, so it requires another. So, when mere physical man, physical line of evolution brings out, it is only a form, unconscious, devoid of intellect, but super spiritual in abstract contemplation. But spirit is unconscious of the form. There is a condition. So for the universal scheme of self-realization to take place, it requires another factor, and which is mind, manasik, intellectual principle. This another line of evolution, intellectual or manasik evolution. Now, which lights up when the light, which this intellectual line of evolution, the mind principle is lit up with the mindless man who is super spiritual. So, bringing the spirit and matter into contact. So, man becomes self-conscious. So, when this occurs at the far distant point of time, modern evolution doesn't speak of it, doesn't know about it. We are speaking of ancient evolutionary thing. Then it is spoken of in the book of Genesis, we'll come to that. And he has become self-conscious. He is aware of his divinity. And at the same time, he is aware of the animal nature in which he is situated. This is the condition of awakened man. So man is a product of threefold evolutionary scheme. Now, coming to the physical line of evolution before the mind is lit up. The secret doctrine teaches that it was a very ethereal model first, which Somapipitris, as Manudharma Shastra says, fashioned it on the pattern of the heavenly man. It was sexless. Potentiality of both the sexes are there, inherent in it, but first stage is sexless, immortal, deathless, ethereal. And then further down towards more and more materialization, it transformed into the mode of reproduction, which was sweat-borne. Like, you have some plants from the spores of which the reproduction takes place. Similarly, in those times, the gigantic huge spore forms produced by its own exudations, spore-like. And all this, mind you, is taught in the Puranas, provided you know how to use the symbolism and study it. And then comes the next, still less ethereal and more material state of third root race, then becomes hermaphrodites. Man is a hermaphrodite in the past. Hermaphroditism can be seen everywhere in nature. Though separation of sexes has taken place now in all the kingdoms of nature, still nature retains some specimens of hermaphroditism in some of the lower forms of life, you can see. And also even today, as our doctor is here, you can vouch for it, every man and woman has the rudimentary organ of the opposite sex. Why? Because man was originally hermaphrodite. And this hermaphrodite man was very spiritual. And comes the next fourth, the next stage of downward separation of the sexes, become individual sex, separation. Now this is where separation of sexes has taken place. The human form has become more gross and gigantic in shape and mindless, still mindless. And this is what referred to in the book of Genesis as Adam of the dust. Adam before the fall, not Adam of the dust. When physiological evolution takes place around the ethereal model, then Adam of the dust comes. He is now Adam before the fall. Now comes the next stage, manasic evolution. Now forms are ready. Now there's another race of ethereal races who are highly spiritual beings, referred to in Manava Dharma Shastra as Kumaras, as Agnishwati Pitris, as Solar Devas. Who are they? They are manasic entities who had become self-conscious in spirit many, many manmantaras before. And when this new stream of evolution took place, they would not take part in creation of physical forms. Their mission is different. When the lower angels have made the physical form according to the cosmic laws, then comes, according to karmic law, for those high Jivan Muktas to incarnate in those forms, and man becomes alive with spiritual consciousness. So they are solar gods. Now when they incarnate in the most select, highly developed forms, they are produced by Kriya Shakti, which is the power of will, spiritual will, thought born of spiritual ideation. Will. They produce instantaneously numerous human forms, and in which the returning Nirvanis from prior Manmantaras incarnate, and you have a nursery of great adepts, rishis and munis formed on earth. And this hierarchy of high beings are referred to as the wondrous being, the initiator, the Mahadeva. There are munis and rishis though, which ancient Indian scriptures speak of, the great sacrifice. It is like saying, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, there is nothing for me to learn which I have not learned, there is nothing for me to obtain which I have not obtained, yet I am indefatigable in action. So that is the condition of those beings. They have nothing to learn, nothing to obtain, but they make the great sacrifice of their further cosmic evolution progress to incarnate in order to help the less progressed brethren, average humanity. They are referred to in our Voice of the Silence as the great guardian wall which protects humanity, instructs, helps in our evolution. Now that is one stage. But the celestial races, celestial Jnani Bodhisattvas, are not all of the same development. Some have reached emancipation, all right, but they have not yet reached complete self-consciousness in the prior Manvantaras. Now it is their turn to incarnate in the formless races. They have free will according to their karmic law, the appropriate form they choose and incarnate in them, and man becomes alive. The two things take place. The celestial, heavenly, solar gods acquire human nature, and here the physical man becomes conscious of his divinity. So the marriage of heaven and earth. Of this wonderful phase, I'll read one short passage from the secret doctrine. Now this is what in the book of Genesis spoken of as the serpent tells Eve, look, you eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you will become wise, you will become immortal, you will know all. This is the meaning of it. Serpent is a symbol of spiritual mind, spiritual manasic principle. Serpent is a symbol of higher ego, and also this symbol of the lower ego in its evil aspect. In its higher good aspect, it is the higher ego. Now, I'll read this portion when this great event takes place in the human evolution. No sooner had the mental eye, my eyesight is very poor, no sooner had the mental eye of man been opened to understanding, spiritual understanding, than the third race felt itself one with the ever-present as the ever-to-be-unknown invisible all, the one universal deity, endowed with divine powers and feelings in himself, his inner God. Each felt he was a man-god in his nature, though an animal in his physical being, physical self. Now comes the struggle. Now he knows his divinity inside, but the power of the animal instinct is also there. So he has to contend with these two forces. Now, I'll read further. Endowed with divine powers and feeling himself his inner God, each felt he was a man-god in his nature, though an animal in his physical self. The struggle between the two began from the very day they tasted of the fruit of the tree of wisdom. A struggle for life between the spiritual and the psychic on the one hand, and the psychic and the physical on the other begins. Those who conquered the lower principles by obtaining mastery over the body joined the sons of light, emancipated beings. Those who fell victims to their lower natures became the slaves of matter. From sons of light and wisdom, they ended by becoming sons of darkness. Satanism, this is called the myth of fallen angel. They had fallen in the battle of mortal life. They had fallen in the battle of mortal life with life immortal. And all those fallen became the seed of future generation of Atlanteans who fell into wickedness. So this is the great transformation that takes place, and the origin of sin, as you people ask, where did evil begin? This way evil begins. And I read one more part in the another part of the secret doctrine. During human life, the greatest impediment in the way of spiritual development, and especially to the acquirement of yoga powers, is our physiological senses. Sexual action being closely connected by interaction with the spinal cord and the gray matter of the brain, and some part of the brain is a seat of spiritual consciousness, it gets atrophied. See the problem of sex here? So your divine creative willpower is transformed as physical procreation, and abuse of physical procreation has a devastating effect on the spiritual powers. Man becomes more and more degraded. So you see the two poles of man's being. Now this is the curse spoken of in the book of Genesis. What is curse here? Curse is not any God pronounces the curse. Curse is only this. What the secret of the says is that it does not mean, curse means that any personal being or God or superior spirit pronounced it, but simply the cause which could but create bad results had been generated, and that the effects of karmic cause could lead beings that countered the laws of nature and thus impeded her legitimate progress only to incarnations hence to suffering. So man brings upon himself the curse. Now what happens is we have the spiritual eye in the brain, center of the brain. Science is unable to tell what the pineal gland is. The pineal gland is the spiritual eye of man, which at one time when the light of Manas was lit up, was active in full bloom. So he had spiritual clairvoyance. Now with his physiological senses becoming prominent and karma developing, developing, and sexual abuses take place, then it gets atrophied. So it has been, nature has retreated into the center of the brain and keeping it protected for future use. This is what the secret doctrine says. Some information for our doctor.
They still don't know what really the functions of the pineal glands are. Some say it creates a hormone called melatonin, which helps in wake and sleep cycle. So that's the only maximum thing what they know. Thank you. Exactly why pineal gland is there. Now, this is the curse. Now,
does it mean that the procreative activity is sin? Not at all. It's abuse is sin. Nature never intended that that it should be put to abuse. So man abuses it only to his own detriment. Now I'll read again a portion how its abuse is highly detrimental, and how all our diseases which afflicts mankind today is because of that abuse. Now, I'm reading from, again, secret doctrine. But with the arts, the fire received, now this incarnation of Manas into man is allegorized in the Greek mythology as Prometheus bringing fire from heaven to suffering mankind in darkness. Mankind in mental darkness, the fire of Manas was lit up, Promethean. And Prometheus is shown as bound on the rock of Caucasus, which means man is imprisoned in the flesh. But with the arts, the fire received has turned into greatest curse, the animal element, and the consciousness of its possession has changed periodical instincts into chronic animalism and sensuality. It is this which hangs over humanity like a heavy funeral pall. Thus arises the responsibility of free will, the titanic passions which represents humanity in its darkest aspect, the restless insatiability of the lower passions and desires, when with self-asserting insolence they bid defiance to the restraint of law. Right? And then H.B. goes on to show the animal world having simple instincts to guide by has its seasons of procreation and senses, and the sexes become neutralized during the rest of the year. Therefore, the free animal knows no sickness but only once in its lifetime. Animals in the wild know no sickness. They have only one sickness before dying, because they never abuse that faculty. Therefore, you see, the normal function of sex for procreation is not a sin. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that the karma should be regulated by moral fitness. Right? There is no sin in carrying out natural functions. But when we abuse it, a terrible karmic cause is set up and comes the retribution man suffers. And many diseases are due to this. Now, what the secret doctrine says is this, that nor was the curse of karma called down upon them for seeking natural union, as all the animal world does in its proper seasons, but for abusing the creative power, for desecrating the divine gift and wasting the life essence for no purpose except bestial personal gratification. Nature had never intended that woman should bring forth her young in sorrow. Animals never bring forth their offspring in sorrow. It's natural for them. But in case of man, it is a sorrow because of karmic retribution of abuse. Since that period, however, during the evolution of the fourth race, there came enmity between its seed, the seed of the fourth race, and the serpent seed. Serpent here means spiritual wisdom. The seed produced by karma and the divine wisdom. For the seed of woman or lust, here woman is not merely a female person. Woman always means matter, concupiscence, symbol of it. For the seed of the woman or lust bruised the head of the seed of the fruit of wisdom and knowledge. So with that, the divine faculty of knowing truth atrophied. By turning the holy mystery of procreation into animal gratification, hence the law of karma bruised the heel of the Atlantean race by gradually changing physiologically, morally and physically and mentally the whole nature of the fourth race of mankind. From a high spiritual being, he became like us, diseased. See? And HBB says, disease and overpopulation are facts never to be denied. And many of the hereditary diseases which afflict mankind today flows from this particular abuse. Now, this is what is meant by crucifixion. That is, Christ is said to be crucified at the cross. What does it mean? It means only this. The divine Agos, who incarnated the divine Prometheus to succor and emancipate mankind, he brings fire from heaven, metaphorically speaking. So the divine ego is incarnate in man, and man has crucified him with the cross of flesh, crucifixion. Now the task before man is, his dharma is to crucify the animal passions on the cross of spiritual knowledge and emancipate himself and work for emancipation of all beings. Fulfill that great purpose for which we are here. That is the dharma, that is the duty of our humankind. So it is spiritual regeneration. Now, Dhammapada is very clear on that. So also Jesus Christ and every great teacher, Bhagavad Gita. To do evil comes very easy. You had a reading in the Dhammapada. But to do really good requires tremendous effort and knowledge. and will effort. To do evil, evil is very easy. And Buddha clearly warns that strive after self-improvement. If you neglect it, you will go down. There are only two paths before man. There is no third alternative. Either to go on the path of right or on the path of wrong. So we have to pluck the tree. We have to pluck from the tree of knowledge of good and evil and eat. We have no alternative. So which one will pluck and eat? I'll read another part. Now, what is the final outcome of it all? Immense suffering. Through this suffering comes knowledge. Now, the teachers say that humanity has reached the bottom of the cycle, and well on its way, the pendulum of evolution is definitely having reached the lowest nadir, is on the upswing. So, it will be tendencies towards spiritual evolution and subjugation of the animal and bring it in line with the spiritual. And there is a task before humanity at the present time. Of this, I'll read a small part in the Secret Doctrine. Man will re-become the free titan of old, but not before cyclic evolution has re-established the broken harmony between the two natures. Which two natures? His divine nature and his animal nature. The terrestrial and the divine. After which he becomes impermeable to the lower titanic forces, karma. Invulnerable in his personality, immortal in his individuality, which cannot happen before every animal element is eliminated from his nature. When man understands that man has created it himself, and he will re-become the Prometheus before his fall. So, now conscious self-regeneration and through self-discipline and emancipation, he has to take his destiny and evolution in his own hands and effect it with knowledge. That is a task before the whole humanity at the present time. Now comes how important these teachings are. Every great religious teacher has emphasized it. Now, in the Patanjali Yoga aphorisms, five duties are mentioned. Manava Dharma. And he says, these five duties are not for yogis. This is not for saints. It is for common man, for every individual. He says, sovereign universal duties. What are they? Non-violence, ahimsa, non-stealing, asteya, non-covetous, not coveting, aparigraha, truthfulness, satya, and continence, brahmacharya. So this continence, brahmacharya, is not for yogis, not for saints. It is for every man. It is for the youth. It is for the married man, householder. It is for everyone. Now, does it mean that everyone should become sannyasi, and become we have a very wrong idea of brahmacharya? No. It is not so. So, it means to observe the immutable law of continence. There is something known as the law of continence. It is not entering into monasteries and put up an austral robe and sit there, or go to a Himalayas and sit there. No. You have to follow the law of continence in your youth and in your householder's life. It is applicable to all. It is a natural law, breaking of which involves man, a spiritual being, into one of the worst of beasts on earth. What is it? I'll read a magnificent portion from Krishnamurti's article. Tolstoy wrote on this, one of the greatest psychologists of our times. He wrote two books, Anna Karenina, many of you might have read it, and then Death of Ivan Ilyich, in which he speaks of the law of continence, which our Western readers never understood. They criticized him. Look, this man is talking nonsense. He wants all of us to go to monasteries. HBB defends him, saying he's not teaching you that. He's teaching you the natural law of continence. What is it? Now, this is one of the characters in his book, Death of Ivan Ilyich. He speaks of it. And HBB comments on that. It is not monasticism, but the law of continence as taught by Jesus, and occultism in the esoteric meaning, which Christians are unable to perceive what he preaches. Nothing can be more moral and more conducive to human happiness and perfectibility than the application of this law. It is one ordained by nature herself. Animals follow it instinctively, as do also savage tribes. Once pregnant to the last day of the nursing of her babe, that is, for the 18 or 20 months, the savage squaw is sacred to her husband. The civilized and semi-civilized man alone breaking this beneficent law. Now, this is the sacredness of the institution of marriage, which, to what level the institution of marriage has been brought down to now, the unions performed on commercial basis, on mere sensual love, for the greatest and for mere gratification. So, one of the characters in that book goes on to say, for morality to exist between man and women in their daily life, they must make perfect chastity their law. In progressing towards this end, man subdues himself. All the great scriptures speak of Atma Samyama, self-restraint. Buddha spoke in the Dhammapada of self-restraint, Atma Samyama, Atma Nigraha, Indriya Nigraha. So I read that again. For morality to exist between men and women in their daily life, they must make perfect chastity their law. In progressing towards this end, man subdues himself. When he has arrived at this last degree of subjection, we shall have moral marriages. That is the task before humanity today, to gather himself and raise himself from the degradation into which he has fallen to the higher level. He has to do it consciously by his own effort. But if a man, as in our society, advances only towards physical love, even though he surrounds it with deception and with a shallow formality of marriage, he obtains nothing but license to vice. So marriage has become a license. So what is spoken of here as continence is a very, very important point. It is mental and moral continence, not mere physical restraint. Mental and moral continence. What does it mean? What do we mean by that? Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, one who restrains his physical organs but meditates on his mind on things of the sense is a false pietist, a bewildered soul. This is what Jesus also says. If a man looks at a woman with lustful eye, he has already committed adultery with her. This is moral. How do you look upon other sex? In absence of spiritual knowledge, you look upon with eyes of lust. And that is, you have already, you know, the creative divine essence is already, you become corrupted of it. You have polluted your whole being. So what Tolstoy says through his character in his novel is this: I did not at that time understand that the words of the gospel as to looking upon a woman with the eye of desire did not refer only to wives of others, but especially about to one's own wife. So this is mental or moral chastity. And he goes on to say, moral continence and chastity mistaken for monasticism. And H.P. goes on to show that that mere physical contact and physical union for the purpose of purely for the purpose of procreation is not at all intended by nature. It's beneficial. But when it's abused, it becomes terrible sin. And she goes on to say, she has met with women who, although the mother of numerous family, had withal remained all her life mentally and morally a pure virgin. So mental and moral virginity, or with a vestal in vulgar talk, a spinster, who although physically undefiled, yet surpassed in mental and more unnatural depravity. So it's all, you know, mind, right? So this is nothing new in ancient Indian ethos. We have the in the institution of Manu, which was followed in the whole of ancient India, when the ideal of householder's life was held in highest esteem. I'll read that part. That it is something that especially in India, we as the students of ancient wisdom must try to work towards the great end and bring it about. I'll read the part. Let me try to get that. Now, she is speaking of Manu here. How wise and grand, how foreseeing and morally beneficent are the laws of Manu on connubial life, when compared with the license tacitly allowed to man in civilized countries. That those laws have been neglected for the last 2 millenniums does not prevent us from admiring their foresight. The Brahmin was a grihastha, a family man, till a certain period of his life, when, after begetting a son, he broke with married life and became a chaste yogi. His very connubial life was regulated by his Brahmin astrologer in accordance with his nature. Therefore, in such countries as Punjab, for instance, she wrote it in 1888, where the lethal influence of Musliman and later on European licentiousness had hardly touched the orthodox Aryan caste, one still finds the finest men, so far as the stature and physical strength go, on the whole globe, whereas the mighty men of old have found themselves replaced in the Deccan, and especially in Bengal, by men whose generations become with every century almost with every day year dwarfed and weakened. So this is the overall context in which the debate that's going on in the country now has to be viewed. In absence of this knowledge, no such reform can take place. Now, can all this be taught in the schools? Hardly. As Buddha says in the Bhagavad Gita, first one has to establish oneself on the path one should go and then teach others. Now, what is required in our country, in our fallen land, is the reinstitution of the ideal of householder's life. Grihastha dharma, chaturashrama dharma, and the 4 stages of life are based on that spiritual knowledge and understanding. Unless that is revived, and that's where the true reform lies, and that is to be attempted. In absence of any such reform, no other remedy can be found for the ills that bedevil us. So that reform begins with individual reform. So that's what Mr. Judge says in his teachings, that every true student of theosophy, right, has this task before him of entering into this truly moral wedding life and bring up a family in the highest ideal. So, as Krishna teaches the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, those who do this with a view to benefit mankind are the greatest benefactors. He discharges his true dharma. And when one lives that higher life, sets up a family on that high ideals and principles, then the high souls from other spheres are attracted to such families and help in regeneration of the country of mankind. That is the ideal theosophy places before us.